What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, episode 76, Post-Surgical Depression, recorded April 9th, 2014. Our special guest this week is Mike Naren. He is actually the pastor at my church, and he is also my father-in-law. So we're going to be talking to him about the depression that he experienced after his shoulder surgery. But first, I am your host, Jeremy Jackson, and with me today is...
George.
Marlon.
Edith.
Brianna.
Jocelyn.
Marissa.
If you would like to join our conversation, you can check out sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. You can also use the hashtag TheSMB, so that's the word the, T-H-E-S-M-B, on Twitter. And George can see that there, or Brianna can see that in the stream. Or if you tweet directly to me, which is at PHS Sports Med, then Marlon should be able to see that there, and they can either ask your questions or respond to you there. Todaysmeet.com/sportsmedicinebroadcast seems to be a good one if you're listening with your class. If your students are listening, that one seems to be open more than some of the other ones. So again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com has links to all of those. So before we get started, I wanted to kind of talk about depression because, you know, Mike had experienced, or Mr. Naren, I guess as you would say, has experienced it kind of in depth, and then he's overcome that, you know, from the surgery, but also as, you know, Sarah, she had the first kid, she was experiencing depression, the postpartum depression. And so now that she's pregnant again, I want to be able to know what to do to help prevent that. So.
What?
Huh?
Wait, what? Huh?
She's pregnant again?
Yep.
We didn't know this.
I know.
Jackson, I thought we tell each other everything. No.
Congratulations.
So, yeah, she is due in November, so right around Thanksgiving time.
Oh, look at me.
I was wondering what you guys would do. It was pretty cool. Everybody was just silent for a minute.
Congratulations, Sarah, if you're watching.
That's actually where I was on Monday. That's why I wasn't here. All right, so moving on from that. But depression is a very real thing, and I never, it's just for me, I've never struggled with it, so I don't really have any idea how to deal with it, and so... It's best to talk to someone that has dealt with it and then moved on from it to go from there. So, without much further ado.
Mr. Naren, please tell us who you are and what you do.
My name is Michael Naren, and I'm a pastor at Second Baptist Church here in Pasadena. And I do a lot of work with some of the community. I head up the National Day of Prayer. Some of you may have been a part of that at times, and I do some things community-wide with a lot of different churches and community events.
Tell us about your shoulder injury.
Well, I played a lot of sports when I was younger. And being in youth ministry at one point, I had hundreds of kids that liked to get out and play around. And so years ago, I was with a camp or with a retreat, and we were playing some dumb game that somebody with a good arm would throw the football just straight up in the air, and then whoever came down with it. Problem is, when you came down with the football, you probably came down with about 20 guys on top of you. And that's what happened, and I'm laying there, and all of a sudden I notice that there's extreme pain in my shoulder, and I don't know what to do. I don't want to get up. And a buddy of mine reached down and grabbed that arm and tried to pull me up by it, jerk me up by it. And, of course, I just about fainted. But I went to the emergency room. They did what they could to reset it, put me in a stupid harness that just drove me nuts, and told me to come back and see about it. Well, I did what a lot of people did, and I didn't go back to see about it. So the injury got worse and worse through the years. So it began to really bother me a few years ago. It became real weak, and I would make certain moves, and it would catch. And one night I was turning the bath water on in the bathtub, and when I bent over to turn it on, my shoulder popped out of place just by turning the faucet in the bathtub. And I thought, you know, I might need to see about this because I have grandkids that I might drop because it was real weak. So that's what prompted me to go and have it seen about.
Do you know, did they actually tell you what happened? Was it like a labrum tear? Was it? Rotator cuff tear.
There was a lot of damage in the rotator cuff. There was a tear there, some real bad situation in the rotator and in the cuff. And there was also a tremendous, because of the injury, there was tremendous amount of arthritis on the ball of the joint. And he told me that the ball had tremendous arthritis, but he said I was like a 90-year-old person with arthritis building up for years. But fortunately, the socket was not as affected. So, but there was a repair on the what'd you call it? The labrum.
The labrum. Yeah.
Yeah, and there was repair somewhere else, and I meant to look that back up, and I forgot.
All right. So it didn't bother you until you got older. It didn't get weakened because if you were doing this when you were young and in the youth ministry, did you have kids at that point?
Yeah, I had kids all through that. And I never noticed anything. My other shoulder was, I had knee problems because I'd blown those out. In fact, I used to joke that I had a brace for almost every part of my body, and I've been stitched up in so many areas. But I knew that my other shoulder and arm had problems because I did a lot of pitching, and baseball pitching, and I knew that I'd thrown that out, and it gave me problems. But this just started about 5 years before the surgery. It began to really bother me in movement and some weakness. But I think that the doc said that was mainly because the arthritis had set in, and that was what was giving me the pain and maybe giving the weakness, because it was wearing out the there and causing the problems.
Why did you decide to finally have it fixed?
Well, it just became progressively worse, and I really became afraid that I was going to drop things. That night when I turned on the water, my shoulder I bent over and stretched out my arm, and my shoulder popped out of joint. I mean, I thought, that's not normal. So I thought it was going to give me problems by weakening.
I don't think I knew that. I know a lot, we spent a good bit of time together, but I don't think I knew that it popped out of joint. Did it go back in? Did you have to go to the hospital to get it reset?
No, it went right back in. That was the strange thing. It was almost like I could almost pop it out and in, but there was so much weakness. So I went to the doc, and we at first tried to rehab. I went to rehab, and we did exercises trying to do that, but it was not progressing to the point that I was getting satisfaction. So I went to the surgeon.
Gotcha.
What was actually done?
Well, actually, you're talking to somebody that had a surgery that is not the normal. A lot of people talk about rotator cuff surgery, but mine was quite different. In fact, my doctor, Dr. Mark LeBay, is one of the few people at that time that was doing it, I think, in the world. And what he did was he took the socket and he scraped inside of the socket. He opened my shoulder up. He scraped inside of the socket down to blood. And then he took cadaver flesh and he did a graft of cadaver flesh inside the socket. So I didn't have your normal rotator cuff surgery in that. He repaired the labrum and other things, but he scraped that down to flesh. So I kind of joke that it doesn't bother me except for the cadaver. The dead person's flesh kind of moans at night, late at night, and wakes me up.
All right, so you said he was one of the only people that does that?
At that time, I understood that he was one of the few people in the world doing that. It was rather experimental. And they had been doing it for a number of years, but they were still experimenting and kind of tracking how well it was taking place. My other option was to have a replaced shoulder socket, and I really didn't want metal if I could keep out of it.
Yeah, that's a whole different thing altogether. And then I'm not an expert in shoulder or joint replacements, but from what I understand, most of the time it's going to have to be replaced again in, 15 years or something like that.
That was the thing that bothered me, is I was going to have that replaced. And I thought, if I can have something natural, maybe that will be a little more acceptable to my body.
I agree. And I like that he sent you to rehab first, because, some surgeons are just, all right, well, let's just jump into surgery, but I think that the good ones are like, well, let's see what we can do conservatively. Or they'll say, we can, surgery is always the last option.
Yeah, I felt that too. I was glad that they did that rather than just jump on it and say, let's go in and open you up.
Can you talk about the first few days of the surgery?
Well, first of all, with all of my injuries, I had been put to sleep only a few times, and I really don't think I grabbed hold of what was going to happen afterwards. Like I said, it wasn't a normal rotator cuff surgery. So when they put me to sleep, I woke up, and I remember in recovery, I woke up yelling the word numb because my arm was totally numb. I could not feel my finger. I mean, it was just killing me with the pins and needles all in it. And so I'm yelling in the post-surgery, numb. That's all I could think of, you know, and my wife's trying to calm me down and quiet me down. I mean, there are a lot of people who say dumb things post-surgery and in recovery, but I was really not prepared for the total change in my body. I mean, you hear that, you know, you've got recovery time and that it's rough, but I had to, opposite of a lot of shoulder surgeries, they start you moving right away. And with mine, I had to wait 30 days. I had to wait over a month, really, before I could move it at all. Every day I could take it off, the sling off, and hold my arms straight down and do this number, but I could not move the shoulder because the graft had to set, and it would damage the graft. So I had an extra 30 days for my muscles and everything to really atrophy or to, you know, have problems. So when I started doing rehab, it was murder. But I think it was at that point that I really got a shock to my system that I was in a bad way, worse than what I thought. And I think that's what depression brings, is when you meet something that you have not anticipated. And I think depression in everybody's life in some way or another seeps in somewhere.
The only time I remember being under anesthesia, put to sleep, was whenever I had my tonsils taken out. And I remember the first thing after waking up, like, I said, water, because, you know, your throat's dry because you've been open. So then I take a sip of water and then immediately turn to the side of the bed and puke on my dad's shoes. So anesthesia can mess you up.
Yeah. Well, I had my tonsils out, too, at age 25. I used to tell everybody that I went through puberty at 25 since I had my tonsils out then. But it was nothing like this. I just did not expect all that was ahead of me and the long road.
All right, so why don't you tell us about that?
Well, after the 30 days, first of all, sleeping was unbelievable. And that added to, you know, when your body gets stressed, God has made our body to where when it gets stressed, it sends out signals. And one of the things of not getting enough rest is you can be emotionally really drained. And I would sleep a lot of times with my arm on top of my wife would turn on her side, and I would put my arm on top of her for about 30 minutes. Then I'd take it down and I'd move it. There was no comfortable position after I could move it. The first 30 days I slept on my back, and I'm a stomach sleeper, slept on my back, and my arm was just right across my chest. There was no moving at all. The doctor said, do not move it. And if you've ever been immobile in some area, it's not like wearing a cast on your leg where you move that leg, you know, along with your walking. It just was maddening to have that shoulder not being able to move. And then when I did be able to move it, I was glad to be able to do this number at first, maybe 2 degrees of the shoulder. And I would lay on my bed afterwards with some of the rehab. And I would have, well, first of all, I set up a pulley system on the back of one of the doors with some rope and an old pulley I had. And I'd hold on to the rope, and then I'd pull it up to stretch those. And it was just unbelievable. I mean, I got it up to here for the first little bit, and that was awful. And then finally, pulling it up over my head was just a major event. And you do that 10 times a day, and you're wore out, and you go, I've been an athlete. What is this that I've got to do this, and I can't do the least little. I couldn't pick up a glass of water. I couldn't, you know. So the depression came mainly because of unreal expectations of being able to get through this in 30 days. I thought I'd be able to move around in 30 days. And then they start telling me, no, it's going to be 6 months to a year, your rehab. And they said the danger mainly with something like that is you've got just a short time to really get your motion back or your range of motion. Your strength you can get back anytime, but your range of motion, if you allow, if I was to have only gone up here about halfway, then if I didn't do it any further, this would be it for my life. You could not repair your range of motion. So that kind of spurred me a little bit.
What are some of worst things about having a surgery?
I think rehab is probably the worst thing about surgery. The surgery itself, doctors do their job, and if you don't have complications, you know, you're in, and I didn't. I was very pleased with the surgery, but rehab is just, rehab's no fun at all.
Can you tell us about the depression you experienced?
Yeah, being a follower of Jesus, I used to really think that depression was not an option for me because, after all, you have God in your life. You ought to be able to in some way handle whatever. But the truth is, I think everybody goes through depression, whether it's over a relationship or surgery. But I think it's always over unreal expectations. And you come face to face with something that you didn't expect or something that is beyond you. And this was beyond me. I got real depressed. My wife is, can I say this on the air? My wife's giving me a bath, you know, and I can't reach my back and I can't move this. And if I do, it's excruciating. I mean, it's not just uncomfortable. And so it was very demeaning to me to have to rely on somebody where I had never done that. And so that depression really set in over the unreal expectation.
So there was just a real sense of hopelessness?
Yeah, I really almost gave up hope. That I got to thinking, I'm just not going to do this. I'm not doing this. There's no way my arm's going to go back to where it was. I really, for the first time in my life, I'm an eternal optimist, but I really almost gave up and said, I'm just going to get it okay. And I'm not going to worry about it. And so I came close to doing that.
I know with Sarah, there was a lot of things. The birth of your first child is a tremendous change. And no matter what kind of movies you watch, no matter what kind of books you read or what kind of classes you take, you're not really experienced or you're not ready for the experience of everything changing, of the emotions, of the postpartum depression, of the neediness of the child, of the not sleeping. And so, I've said it before, I definitely messed up by not taking off those 2 weeks. You know, Jonah was born on a Friday or Saturday, and I went back to work on a Monday because there was things I hadn't gotten ready yet. And so I should have taken off that time and just said, you know what, I can make up this work later at some point, but I didn't. And that was probably a big part of it. But also, I was talking with Sarah last night about this, and she said, you know, there was times where she didn't want Jonah. She didn't want to be a mom because of the depression, she's like, you know, it's just, I just want to be me again. I don't want to be Jonah's mom. I don't want to be this thing that with a poopy baby or crying baby or, you know, even a sleeping baby always in my arms. I just want to be me. I just want to be back to normal. And there was times where she would get upset with me because she was in there nursing Jonah while I was washing dishes. I'm washing dishes. I'm doing this so that you don't have to do this, so that you can sit there and rest. But she would be upset with me because I wasn't sitting there with her. But that was just because of depression. And so it just, like you said, unrealistic expectations of, you know, you just don't have any idea what to expect.
Well, I think depression gives way to irrational thought. You really don't reason well. And God has so linked our physical body to our mental and emotional condition. And the ancients understood that. In fact, they always linked the body, the mind, and the spiritual being together rather than how we do it. We try to separate those. But I'd be curious how many of your of you guys that are here today have gone through somewhat of a little bit of depression. Have y'all?
Anybody?
Have you gone through a little bit? Maybe you'd say, I just got depressed for a minute or a day or something about something. You know, I mean, all of it's a normal process because something upsets our normal. I found myself saying, I wish I'd have never had this surgery. Now, today, I'm very glad I had it, but I really felt like, hey, let's back this clock up somehow. I felt stupid. I felt like I could somehow close my eyes, go back to sleep, and wake up, and I hadn't had this done. And it wasn't going to happen. So it was really disconcerting to try to rationalize with the irrational thoughts you do. You know, you think you can fix it with some dumb stunt, and you can't go back. You know, you've got to go through it and make your way through the depression.
I remember there was times where you would go to put Jonah in the car and you had trouble lifting him up before the surgery because your shoulder was so weak, you know. And then obviously, like, compare your hope, your feelings then of, I guess, inadequacy because you can't lift up a 20-pound kid versus your feelings during your rehab and your recovery.
Well, I think that was one of the things that God brought to my mind. As I was struggling through this and really trying to pray through it and really trying to gain some strength through it, I began to think, okay, Naren, why did you do this surgery? You know, sometimes we have to think, why am I, what is it worth it? Well, yeah, it's worth it because I can pick Jonah up. And Jonah's a, you know, I mean, Jonah weighed a lot then, nothing like Sam does. I mean, Sam is one bag of, you know, potatoes. But, man, I got thinking, I want Papa to be able to pick them up and them to not be afraid and me not to be afraid I'm going to drop them. So that was something God really used. And the other was, I just thought, you've been tough most of your life, but you've never faced anything like this. Buck it up, Naren, and get busy. So I'd lay on my bed with a broom handle in both hands. I'd lay on my back on the bed, and one of my exercises, which I thought was the dumbest thing in the world, it's a broom handle. It's not even weighted. And I would take it, and I would go back like this over my head till I could touch the covers on the bed over my head with my arms straight. I remember the first day I finally touched, and I thought, I am excited over the dumbest exercise I've ever seen. So it was focusing on the goal of what was good and was going to be good for my body. And God brought that clear to me when he made me see what the objective was, you know, again.
Can you tell us how you overcame the depression?
I did it through, excuse me, like I said, focusing on why, but I also did it through a lot of prayer and a lot of dealing with my irrational thoughts. One of the things I think is so important is that God gives us, he says in the Word, that he gives us a spirit of a sound mind. And too often, if you really think about it, everybody who does something that they get in trouble for, it's really because they didn't think before they did it. I mean, everything I've ever been in trouble for, and believe me, I've been in trouble for a lot in my life, has been because I didn't think or reason what that was. So God caused me to really begin to reason, what is the reality? I mean, what's a year? When they said a year of rehab, I'm really thinking, oh yeah, I'll beat that curve. But honestly, it was almost a year to the day I had surgery that I finally felt that I had total motion and that I had strength in my arm and I was beginning to see that it was normal. And I still, today, believe it or not, I still have to watch and stretch my arm a lot with the shoulder. And sometimes it'll pop. And I really got concerned with that. I thought, well, maybe it didn't do well. But the rehab guys told me that's a normal thing when you have the shoulder surgery, that it may pop later. But I think it was a lot through prayer and just asking God to focus my thought on what was the goal.
So going backwards just a little bit,
okay.
How do you think that the medicines, like those affected, you obviously they numb the pain, but do you think that those contributed to like a feeling of hopelessness or?
Yes. Here's my take on meds anyway. All meds alter, I'm no doctor, but all meds, if you want to get down to it, all meds alter you physiologically and also emotionally, many of them. And I hate medications. And so I would not take that because, in fact, boy, this is personal. I was taking them at first because it was killing me. In fact, they sent me home with a pouch that I could punch the button. They tell you can punch the button. I really think they're lying. I don't think punching the button. I think they just got it set to where it goes in. You know, I used to tease and say I was punching that button, man, to get something in there, and I don't think it was helping. But the problem is I had that and then meds to take after that, and all of a sudden I couldn't go to the bathroom. I couldn't have a bowel movement, and so I went to the doctor. I was in terrible pain with that. And he told me, he said, well, what happens is that medication often will cause your bowels to shut down because they're being medicated too. And so now I got another problem. So I ditched the medicine at that point and only took it when it was really, really bad. But I think they add to it because they cause you to be, most of them are downers, I think. And so they're going to smooth you out. But in doing so, you're going to have the depression that everything is kind of not as vibrant in life as what you had. I don't know if that's medically correct for what I'm saying. I just know my experience.
Well, that's really what we're asking. I mean, you're not an anesthesiologist or a doctor, so I'm not asking you for expertise, but just your experience with them. But right. As you're observing, you know, those medicines are usually muscle relaxants or things that numb the pain. So like you said, they're downers or things that are going to slow you down or numb or dull things. So
right. I recommend them when you're in bad pain. And I had to take a few the first little bit to get any sleep. But honestly, after that, I found them detrimental to my drive to really do rehab and get better.
So what do you think were some of the big achievements, or maybe not, but the small achievements that made a big difference? I know for a while you had to sleep in the couch, on the chair, on the recliner, because you couldn't lay down because of the pain.
Right.
So what were some of the big achievements for you?
The first day I went back to my own bed was absolutely heaven. It just, laying down in my bed instead of on the recliner, being able to finally feel some stretching way up, moments when I felt that I was making progress were really, and it really taught me something else. It taught me that the little things in life really are important, because I'm always a big picture guy, and I'm seeing myself, believe it or not, my goal was to beat the norm in rehab. I was going to get rehabbed before anybody else in history. And the doc said, you're not going to do that, because you have to take it slow. You can't press it, and you really didn't want pain. You wanted the gradual stretching of that muscle. And at one point, I thought I'd hurt myself because I did do more with weights than I should have. And the guys had to slow me down with that. So the little goals were very important. Let me just say, while you're looking for that, I really miss the fact that I think a Lorena was supposed to be here today.
Yeah.
And my sister, one of my sisters is named Lorena, and I was just looking forward to seeing another Lorena. I don't meet too many of
those. Well, here we say Lorena.
Lorena. Well, I understand that, yeah.
But yes, Lorena usually sits over here and asks questions, speed talks.
Rolling my R's hasn't happened in a while. My Spanish is rusty and my French is really gone to pot.
So on a completely different note, Mike speaks a little bit of French. You know, he's actually born in Louisiana. His wife's from Louisiana. And so French is kind of common. And so when I've been teaching my boys French, when you say rectangle, it's a rectangle, and triangle is triangle. And so now all of the French word, every word that's French, it's kind of like when they just put an O on the end of words to make them Spanish. Mm-hmm. So we just put like Cherong, or or we would say Michelong is
It's like a friend of mine, who, when he speaks Spanish, it's uno, dos, tres, cuatro, cinco, seis. No, uno, dos, tres, cuatro, cinco, six, oh, seven, oh, eight, oh, nine, oh, and ten, oh. And, you know, I studied French for 2 years and Spanish for three, and I speak just a little bit of French, a little better than the Spanish, but I think that's because of the Louisiana background. I like to get on an elevator when people are speaking Spanish and just look at them and smile and nod my head, even though I may not know what they're saying. That's probably cruel.
All right, Jocelyn, you ready?
How do you feel during this depression?
I really felt inadequate. I felt embarrassed. I was really embarrassed that I could not do what I thought I should have been able to do. And so the depression would get me down. Again, unreal expectations. I think that goes to relationships even when you have depression. If you're depressed over a boyfriend or girlfriend, if I can put that out, I think it's because something you feel inadequate. And I felt inadequate. I felt like I could not, you know, do what I thought I should have been able to do. Embarrassed.
You think that was the biggest thing, is embarrassment?
Well, no, hopelessness that I was never going to, this was never going to get back to normal. They must have screwed somebody else's arm into my socket, you know, was what I thought. It just, this was never going to get through. Man, a year to me, you know, I'm impatient to begin with, and it was awful.
All right, so do you feel, again, you know, I think you mentioned at the beginning, but depression is, until you experience it or have somebody that you're really close to experience it, it's kind of a, is it real type thing. And now that you've kind of been through it, do you feel that's a real subject, like a real diagnosis thing kind of thing?
Oh, I think it definitely is. In fact, I'd been through it before when my third child was born with some things that went on. We won't go into that. We're talking about the physical, but I had never experienced it due to something like that. And this was new because this was outside of me. I had not done something to have this. This was not something I could fix automatically. Depression with a relationship, sometimes you can go into it and help it. But this was kind of outside of my body or outside of my, you know, my person. And so I felt helpless to fix it.
All right.
If you had to do it over, would you?
100%. Because my shoulder has the strength now. It's still not where I used to be, but at my age, I'm glad to have that whatever I've got. But yes, I'd have it done. I'd have it do it over again. And I recommend Dr. Mark LeBay for shoulder in Houston. He's one of the premier shoulder guys in Houston, I think.
What are some things that might help us encourage an athlete having surgery?
Tell them everything. As best you can, tell them what's coming. I would even say stretch it to where, you know, tell them the worst case scenarios. You know, I think that's the case. I tell everybody, when you get married, you really don't understand what's coming at marriage. When you have a kid, you have no clue what you're fixing to jump into. You want to know nuts, meet a new parent, you know. But surgery, I would tell athletes, number one, I would tell them the worst case scenario. And then I would tell them that you're going to make it through, because most people make it through that. And then I would remind them that you have got to do what the trainer doctor says within the time frame. Don't try to get ahead or you'll make it worse. You can strain something. In my case, if I raised that arm too soon, I could have ripped that graft of the cadaver out of the socket. So I think it's important that you tell them that and tell them that you're the strength that God put in you and the body that he gave you can go together. And if you methodically do what you should, things turn out good.
On that same note, you know, we're talking about if you're prepping them for surgery, so the kid has an ACL tear. All right, so I think you've torn your ACL. I think you've torn your meniscus. We're going to have to go to the doctor and have the MRI. So then immediately they're thinking, okay, my season's over. Maybe my career's over. What are some of the things, in your opinion, that I can do to, again, encourage them away from depression? I know you said tell them the worst case scenario. So, you know, I've already told them, I think this is what it is. And if you have to, you're probably going to have surgery. So I think I've done that. You know, and here's kind of typically, it's like, all right, I think you tore your ACL in your meniscus. We'll have to go to the orthopedic surgeon to have an MRI to find out for sure. Now, I've been wrong before, but, you know, this is what I feel, and so that's why we're going to send you to the doctor. And if that's the case, the surgery is about, you know, there's the surgery, and then the rehab is somewhere around 6 to 9 months, that kind of thing. And so what's your assessment of how I convey that message to that student?
Well, I think first of all, you have to just put out there, we might be looking at that. I'd rather know when I was athletically engaged, I'd rather know the truth and the bloody truth of whatever is wrong, even to the point of your worst case scenario, as I look into what to do. But one of the things I forgot to tell you, one of the things that encouraged me and would encourage those athletes is always putting in front of them how many people, and I'm a baseball nut, how many pitchers have rehabbed an arm and come back from shoulder surgery, Tommy John surgery and things like that, and pitched again in the major leagues. So there's always this, you know, we're going to see what the bad truth is, but there's always the hope that you can rehab that. And what's a year if you're going to be able to play for a long time? You know, I hear a lot of people trying to decide, do I have surgery? Well, if your doctor recommends it and you trust him, you need to go with what he recommends. You know, if you don't, get a second opinion. And then if you got three opinions that this is what you need to do, you might want to listen to the medical doctor rather than you're feeling like it's going to be a long road, because it is a long road. Tell them that. It's going to be a long road.
So a lot of people will look at, well, a lot of athletes will look at Adrian Peterson coming back from an ACL tear in about 4 months. Again, you know, he's a professional athlete. That's his full-time job. He spends a lot of time doing rehab there. What would that have done to you if I had said, you know, well, some people come back in 6 months from your shouldery. You know, the average is, you know, 9 months, and then some people take 12. What would that have done?
To me, I think it finally encouraged me when things like that encouraged me when it sunk in. But at first, again, I had the unreal expectations. I was going to be the quickest rehab ever on the planet. And that was my impatience kicking in, an irrational thought, rather than consistently going through the rehab. One of the good things that athletes have, and I encourage it, is a work ethic for training. And the more training you do consistently, when you have an injury, I believe that consistent training, had I been doing that before this injury and surgery, I think that would have helped me in the rehab. Because of the consistency. As it was, I'm going, I hadn't exercised in a long time like this, and I thought, it's useless. So that's the good thing athletes have going for them, is many of them are have a good regimen of exercise and training before a surgery or an injury.
Yeah, so the unrealistic expectations is probably a big thing, communicating with beforehand. What were some of the signs or symptoms, things that if I'm in the athletic training room and I have an athlete in there that's in the middle of a ACL rehab or a shoulder reconstruction type surgery, that I can look for and say, hey, this person might be struggling with depression, and then some things in your opinion that some actions I should take then. So again, things that were cues for you, or maybe that Cindy, your wife, saw in you that kind of said, hey, he's got depression going on.
I think for me, and you might look for this with training, is the inconsistency of doing the exercises for rehab, because I think that's where I first saw that I was ready to give up, was I wouldn't do the exercises, or I'd halfway do them, or half-heartedly do them. I think that was the main thing that would tip me off that I was having depression, is I was starting to give up and I wouldn't do the exercise with a purpose, you know, or consistent.
So just lack of consistent effort or lack of focus?
Yeah, yeah. That might be a sign they're giving up.
All right, so again, we're dealing with high school athletes. I think lack of focus is like a full-time job there.
Exactly. But if you've got an athlete, they're used to doing at least some of that consistent prep. Coaches drill that into them, you know, to some degree. But if they're not doing it, I think it's a good time for a pep talk that you can't get discouraged. You know, you've got to do this. And the thing that really hit me physically on that was when my trainer told me one day, he said, look, you've got just this. I think he said 9 months to a year to set your range of motion. And he said, if you do not have full range of motion again, he said, you're not going to get it back. You can get strength anytime. I was worried about strength. I was thinking, I can't lift my arm. It felt like I don't even have an arm there. But he's talking about range of motion. So that reset my goal to range of motion. And then I'd think about lifting weights and getting stronger. But I think focus and telling them, you've got this time frame, and you won't have that motion in that knee anymore if you don't do it, you know, or shoulder.
How important do you think was the physical therapist's role?
It was very important, especially when he gave me the rub downs on my shoulder. That was very important to me. I like the little machine the TENS.
Yeah.
I like the TENS, you know, even though my shoulder would kind of just jerk and everything. I like the fact that, you know, and it was as though somebody was working with me, which, again, is a biblical principle. The Bible says where if a man falls down by himself, then it's pretty sad. But if somebody walks with him, then somebody, he can help him up. And I think that's what the therapist did for me, is each 3 times a week I went in, he'd say, how are you doing? And I'd either tell him the truth or lie. And then he'd say, okay, let's test you today. And so he'd test what my progress was. Rather than me doing it, he was encouraging me, that's good, and you're doing better. So I think trainers and rehab guys are really important, with mine. I think I did better once I started going to rehab with somebody.
Yeah, I feel the same. Whenever I go over to the weight room and work out by myself, it's a lot easier for me to cheat or for to quit early or to not finish those last couple reps. But even if I'm going to the YMCA and I'm not working out with anybody, but there's other people there, I'm more likely to work a little harder. And then if there's somebody else standing there working with me, you know, spotting me or something like that, then I'm a lot more likely to work harder. So I think consistency, like you said, building a relationship, being intentional, tracking progress, all those things can help you.
Well, he had been real kind to me at first because this old guy loved pitching in baseball. And when he tested me before I ever had the surgery, he did some tests on my range of motion. And he said, my gosh, he said, you're a pitcher. You got to be a pitcher. And so, you know, in my old body, I say, yeah, man, I was. And so he used that really to push me. You want that range of motion. You want to have that pitching arm back. You know, of course, I didn't pitch with my left hand, but I had good motion in all of mine. And so that was that was an encouragement from him that was positive and not just, hey, you got to stay on track. So, you know, and that's important. I'm sure somebody who was rehabbing Adrian Peterson was saying, hey, dude, you're the best runner that football's ever seen, you know, and that encouragement is good. And, you know, talking about going to the weight room alone, we also, I was going to say, when he tested me after the surgery, I wanted to hear him say again, hey, you got your pitching arm back, you know. So
yeah.
Going to the weight room alone, nobody's saying, golly, you're lifting a lot, you know. But somebody else is there, they're saying, hey, that's impressive, you know. So that encouragement is there.
Yeah, whenever I go home and tell Sarah I worked out today, I did 15 reps with the 70-pound dumbbell. She's like, that's nice.
Yeah.
Not really. She's not like, oh, just like, that's good, babe, but it's not real. It's not the same as someone being there, you know, somebody that actually can lift that much saying, you know, good job.
Yeah.
So
that's exactly right. It's, you know, it's who says it,
yeah,
you know, at that point.
So.
And this was a younger guy, so I'm thinking, boy, he thinks, you know, I'm a stud with the arm, you know.
Okay, so any final thoughts on post-surgical depression before we close it out?
Yeah, I think it's important that you don't... I worry about people who go through this alone. And I think that one of the best things you can do, even if you're not, you know, with the person all the time, is encourage them and ask them how they're doing and encourage them that you're doing a good job. It's the same way with weight loss or anything. When you say... You know, are you doing well? You look like you're losing weight. You look like you're doing well. Those encouragements, I think, are so important to guard against the depression. And I just encourage those who don't go through that to encourage those that might.
All right, I agree. I think that's consistent encouragement, consistent action, consistent focus. I think that's kind of the theme of what you're saying there. So, I agree. All right, so we will go ahead and close it out.
We want to thank the people who helped make this broadcast possible.
Come on, Jocelyn, we got to work on it.
What?
We got to work on some individuals, some Jocelyn words.
What do you want me to say?
I don't know. We got to come up with something. See, I was playing robots with Jonah this morning. Can't sound like a robot.
I sound like a robot.
Got to come up with something. You don't have to say the stuff that I was joking about. Say, what's up, dog?
No, I'm not like that.
I know. That's what I'm saying. That's why I was just teasing. Just going to make you laugh. But. All right. So go ahead and read it this way. We're going to keep working on it.
Okay. We want to thank the people who helped make this broadcast possible. GHAS for sponsoring CEU opportunities. PISD Education Foundation. Pasadena Health Clinic CEO John Schweitzer and Pam Tevis for all your help pulling off the mass CPR training.
So the mass CPR training. Hey, real quick, we didn't even talk about that. We had 600 plus kids go through mass CPR, the CPR in schools for American Heart Association through a grant there. You guys here that were part of that, just a real quick, what do you think? How did it go?
Good.
Good. Marissa, most of you guys here were helping doing a job, but... Other thoughts?
Yesterday I was in class and like everyone that I saw, they were like, look, I got my card. They were all happy because they got their CPR card.
Nice. Any other thoughts? Any other positive reactions? Anybody saying this was really stupid? Anything like that?
So I'm scared now. Dude, if I go out in the hall and fall down, are 40 people going to jump on me and try to do CPR?
Maybe. But hey, that's better than nobody.
That's true.
It's better than nobody. Edith, you said some of the people were not happy.
Yeah, they were like, it's stupid. Like, why do we learn this? We're never going to use it.
So they were saying that day?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, again, you know, some people think that, but then that's when I go and tell them, hey, Brianna has used this year to save her cousin's life. I had kids each year. And so, you know, like I said, you may go to lunch today and have your best friend choke right next to you and die because you did nothing today.
Oh my gosh, don't say that.
I'm so serious. If Brianna hadn't learned CPR, then her cousin might not be alive today.
Like, think about it. You taught 20 students, and 1 out of 20 students used it.
So it's actually 15.
Oh, 15?
Yep, 1 out of 15.
But what about trainers?
If you were counting all of them, I've had several different ones use it throughout the years, but... So maybe, okay, we'll go with 20, 1 out of 20.
Yeah, and then imagine out of 700...
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it should be about 30, right? Yeah. There you go. So that could be 30 lives saved. So I think it was really cool. I think it went really well. Overall, it was a great job. And I couldn't have done it without you guys here that were helping me. You guys did awesome. I know there was several people saying, you know, they did great bringing us water or running errands for us. So thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And then Laura is over there. Thank you. Lorena is not here. Thank you, Lorena. So again, you guys are awesome, and I appreciate everything you do. So if you want to contact us, you can check out the sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, and then you can email me from there. I think it's info@sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. You can do any of the other ways that Jocelyn's about to tell you about. But again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com has the links to all those, so you can watch live almost every Wednesday and using the hashtag DSMB when we're live so we can ask questions. Jocelyn?
Follow us on Twitter at @PHSSportsMed. Google Plus Sports Medicine Broadcast and facebook.com/PHS Athletic Training.
So for Jeremy,
George,
Marlon,
Edith,
Brianna,
Jocelyn,
Marissa,
and Mike and Aaron, that's a wrap.